on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Hope you're having a good and healthy week. And yes, coronavirus is still in the news, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about that and the mask wearing that seems to be becoming the norm now everywhere we go. But first of all, as usual, starting off with our news roundup and forest bathing. Where you spend time in nature really does work, and it's good to get outside, isn't it? It's a really good thing to do. 2 hours a week in a forest, glade or park will improve your sense of well-being, a new study has discovered. 2 hours doesn't have to be from one visit. The time can be spread over the week and you'll still get similar health benefits. That's according to researchers from the University of Exeter who looked at the health and lifestyles of around 20,000 people. Time in woodlands, town parks, beaches and other natural areas will all reap rewards, providing that you spend about 2 hours or more in them each week. That seems to be the threshold, and people who reported spending less time than that in nature each week also reported lower levels of psychological well-being. Most of the participants found their natural setting less than 2 miles from their home, and even local urban green spaces seem to work, say the researchers. 2 hours a week is hopefully a realistic target for many people, especially as it can be spread over an entire week. And the idea of nature having therapeutic value has been adopted by the Japanese, who call it shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing. It's been proven to reduce stress and anxiety, the researchers say. And cannabis oil, cannabidiol, CBD, a derivative of cannabis and hemp plants. Yes, it's very, very popular now. It's been used to treat epilepsy and pain, and researchers have now discovered it's a very powerful antibiotic, even against serious infections, although obviously I can't say whether or not it will work with COVID, but it's certainly worth trying, isn't it, to support the immune system. It's as effective as some of the frontline antibiotics such as vancomycin and daptomycin, and is a genuine answer to antibiotic resistant bugs. That's according to research at the University of Queensland in Australia. And they made the discovery almost by accident. They'd been testing a synthetic form of CBD on simple skin conditions when they realised it was successfully treating serious staph infections. The cannabidiol continued to be effective over a long time, suggesting the bacteria weren't becoming resistant. CBD also works as an anti-inflammatory, that's according to the research as well, and it can clear up damage caused by the bacterial infection as well. And the most promising news of all is that CBD successfully treats the antibiotic-resistant superbugs and can combat biofilms, a physical form of bacterial growth that leads to hard-to-treat infections. And when it comes to sitting, the many ways we do it aren't equal. Although sitting around has been lumped into one big risk factor for heart disease, how and where we sit carries different risks. Sitting at a desk at work doesn't seem to increase the risk of heart disease, and yet lounging in front of the TV at home does. Previous studies have concluded that the more sedentary people are, the more likely they are to develop heart disease and suffer an early death. But researchers from Columbia University's Irving Medical Center found it wasn't quite so simple. They tracked the lives of about 3,500 black Americans who were at higher risk of diabetes and heart disease, and found that only sitting at home increased the chances further. Those who watched the most TV every day, 4 hours or more, had a 50% increased risk of heart disease compared to those who watched TV for 2 or fewer hours every day. But sitting at a desk at work didn't raise the risk at all, the researchers found after following the group for nearly 9 years, and it didn't seem to matter how long people were at their desks. The one mitigating factor for those who watched the most TV was engaging in 150 minutes or more of strenuous exercise every week. Those who also exercised saw their risk disappear, the researchers found. They aren't sure why sitting at home in the office should carry different risks. It may be that most people tend to watch television for hours without moving, while most workers get up from their desk frequently. The combination of eating a large meal, such as dinner, and then sitting for hours could also be harmful. And even if you don't do strenuous exercise, getting up from the chair and taking a short walk could also lower your risk. And apparently, dairy products can protect against heart disease and type 2 diabetes, but it's only true for women, a new study has found. Despite the growth of the low-fat food industry, a diet high in dairy fat seems to be protective, as several new studies have found. But by pooling the results so far, researchers from the University of Haifa in Israel have concluded that such a diet only reliably reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes for women and doesn't have a marked effect one way or the other in men. They took a look at 201 previously published studies and found, as others had, an inverse relationship between high dairy diets and heart disease overall. In other words, the more dairy fats the study participants ate, the less likely they were to develop CVD or type 2 diabetes, thus confounding the fat's heart disease theory. But digging deeper into the data, they found the effect was only statistically significant for women, with a risk reduction of about 15% for both conditions. They don't know why the risk should be different between men and women. It could be the way the two sexes process dairy fat, but it could also be shown to other dietary or lifestyle factors that may be having an impact as well. So I always think with this research as well, you do need to take all the lifestyle factors into account, because everything works together, doesn't it? And heart attacks and gum health. What causes a heart attack? The standard view has that build-up of bad cholesterol narrowing the arteries is the chief culprit, but new research has found something else is going on. One clue is that people who suffer from very bad gums or periodontal disease are more likely to suffer a heart attack. And another clue is that people with periodontitis are also more likely to be diabetic, even if they don't know it. Another common factor is a condition called dysglycemia, where the body cannot metabolise sugar or glucose properly, which is also what happens when you have diabetes, a condition where you become glucose intolerant. People with the disorder are twice as likely to suffer a heart attack, say researchers from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, who studied the gum health and glucose levels of 712 heart attack patients. The finding puts dentists on the front line of healthcare, and it also means that endocrinologists, specialists in diabetes treatment, should be checking the gum health of patients, the researchers say. Undetected glucose disorders are common in myocardial infarction and periodontitis. Many people visit the dentist regularly, and maybe it's worth considering taking routine blood sugar tests in patients with severe periodontitis to catch these patients. More than 610,000 Americans die from a heart attack every year, and it's responsible for one in every four deaths. And the Karolinska experts have demonstrated it has little to do with cholesterol or arteries clogging up and everything to do with the way our bodies process sugar, especially from processed foods. And poor dental health is linked to liver cancer as well. People with periodontal disease, characterized by bleeding gums and loose teeth, are 75% more likely to develop the cancer. Bacteria seen in periodontal disease has also been found in liver cancer cells. That's according to researchers at Queen's Hospital in Belfast. Liver cancer, or hepatobiliary cancer, seems to be the only gastrointestinal cancer linked to gum disease. There wasn't an increase in the risk for liver, colon, rectum or pancreatic cancers, the researchers say. And the researchers tracked the health of about 460,000 people, about 4,000 of whom developed liver cancer during the 6 years of the study, and poor oral health was reported in 13% of the cases, and most were young, female and living in socially deprived areas. And the researchers weren't sure why periodontal disease should be linked only to liver cancer and not to other gastrointestinal cancers. But one theory is that the liver is diseased before the cancer appears and is unable to properly process bacteria, which in turn triggers the start of the cancer. And liver cancer is the sixth most lethal cancer, with a low survival rate of just 11%. Smoking, alcohol and obesity have all been linked to this cancer in the past. And parents are always telling their children to get out from behind their screens and play outdoors. And now there's a compelling health reason why they could be right. Children with low levels of vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, are more likely to suffer from high blood pressure, even when they're very young. In fact, children born with reduced levels of vitamin D run a 40% increased risk of hypertension between the ages of 3 and 18, and they are more than twice as likely to become hypertensive if their vitamin D levels are consistently low at birth and in early childhood. Researchers from Johns Hopkins University made the discovery when they tested vitamin D levels in 775 children from the time they were born up to their 18th birthday. Children who aren't getting enough sunshine should be given vitamin D supplements or foods rich in the vitamins, such as eggs and salmon, the researchers say. So that's some interesting health news there, isn't it? So we're going to have a little break now. And after the break, I'm going to be talking to you about the virus and the wearing of masks as well, which seems to be becoming the norm for everybody these days. So are you for or against masks? Well, maybe these facts will help to make your mind up. Stay tuned for more after this.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. So yes, we're still in the midst of the COVID crisis or chaos, aren't we? I don't think we're so much at crisis point at the moment. It does seem to be as a little bit more under control than it was. And life is kind of getting back to normal, isn't it? But there are still some restrictions in place, which we are quite well aware of. And one of those is mask wearing. Now, wearing a mask while shopping makes you 13 times more likely to stick to social distancing and engage with measures to slow the spread of COVID-19, a study found. Experts from the University of Erfurt asked nearly 7,000 people their views on masks and their feelings towards other people who do or don't wear face coverings. People wearing a face mask were 7 times more likely to wash their hands, 20 times more likely to avoid handshakes, and 13 times more likely to stick to social distancing. The findings are evidence that a mandatory mask policy is an effective, fair, and socially responsible solution to curb coronavirus. In the UK, face coverings are required on all public transports, in shops and supermarkets, while visiting hair salons and barbers and in places of worship as well. There are fines starting at £100 for failing to comply with these rules that doubles for each repeat offence up to a maximum value of £3,200. Since June 2020, the World Health Organization has recommended that healthy people wear non-medical masks to control the spread of COVID-19, for example, in settings where physical distancing cannot be achieved. In Germany, face masks are compulsory on public transport and while shopping, and in France, they are mandatory in public. Countries increasingly require masks in closed public spaces such as supermarkets, and evidence has accumulated that strategies targeting the susceptible population can effectively contribute to the containment of the outbreak, researchers say. Based on weekly cross-sectional surveys of nearly 7,000 people in Germany during April and May 2020, researchers report that mask-wearing behaviour increased sharply when a mandatory mask policy was implemented. They say this was despite only moderate support for the policy and that mask wearing was associated positively with other protective behaviours. As well as examining the survey data, the team carried out an experiment involving 925 participants involving a fictional scenario and people not wearing a mask. They found that a voluntary mask policy might lead to lower compliance, greater stigmatisation, and be perceived as less fair than a mandatory policy. The results from both studies indicate that, independent from policies, wearing masks is a social contract, wherein compliant people perceive each other more positively and non-compliance is socially punished. This is consistent with previous work from the earlier SARS pandemic, demonstrating that more empathetic people are more likely to wear masks and that empathy can be regarded as a prerequisite for pro-social behaviour. They say that the universal adoption of moderately effective masks could prevent up to 45% of projected deaths over 2 months. And while uptake under a voluntary policy is reasonably high, it's still not sufficient to meet the required thresholds, the team explained. Importantly, since mask wearing is a social contract, high uptake is necessary to prevent stigmatisation, with those wearing masks feeling a sense of appreciation to others wearing a mask in public. Participants who reported wearing a mask frequently in their everyday life perceived greater warmth towards others who also wear a mask than toward others who do not. The team say that government should introduce a mandatory mask policy along with explicit communication of the benefits of mask wearing to slow the spread. So research on how well various types of masks and face coverings varies, but recently and in light of the pandemic, experts are increasingly leaning toward the notion that something is better than nothing. A University of Oxford study published on March the 30th concluded that surgical masks are just as effective at preventing respiratory infections as N95 masks for doctors, nurses and other healthcare workers. It's too early for there to be reliable data on how well they prevent infection with COVID-19, but the study found the thinner, cheaper masks do work in flu outbreaks. The difference between surgical or face masks and N95 masks lies in the size of particles that can, and more importantly can't, get through the materials. N95 respirators are made of thick, tightly woven and moulded material that fits tightly over the face and can stop 95% of all airborne particles, while surgical masks are thinner, fit more loosely and are more porous. Now, this makes surgical masks much more comfortable to breathe and work in, but less effective at stopping small particles from entering your mouth and nose. Droplets of saliva and mucus from coughs and sneezes are very small, and viral particles themselves are particularly tiny. In fact, they're about 20 times smaller than bacteria. For this reason, a JMA JAMA study published this month still contended that people without symptoms should not wear surgical masks because there is not proof the gear will protect them from infection, although they may keep people who are coughing and sneezing from infecting others. But the Oxford analysis of past studies, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, found that surgical masks were worth wearing and didn't provide statistically less protection than N95 for healthcare workers around flu patients. However, any face mask is only as good as other health and hygiene practices. Experts universally agree that there's simply no replacement for thorough, frequent hand washing for preventing disease transmission, and some think the masks may also help to train people not to touch their faces, while others argue that the unfamiliar garment will just make people do it more, actually raising infection risks. So, what about cloth coverings? Although good quality evidence is lacking, some data suggests that cloth masks may be only marginally, 15%, less effective than surgical masks in blocking emission of particles. That's according to researchers at Cambridge University Hospital. And this is also supported by a study led by Public Health England in 2013, which found that wearing some kind of material over the face was fivefold more effective than not wearing masks for preventing a flu pandemic. And the study suggested that homemade masks should only be considered as a last resort to prevent droplet transmission from infected individuals, but it would be better than no protection at all. So there we have it. Mask or no mask. But I think it's better to, with all of these things, really to err on the side of caution. So I'm on the mask wearing front. I'm in that camp because I do think it's better to be safe. But I do also understand that there are certain people that aren't able to wear masks, so there are some exemptions. But I think really, you know, from my point of view, and this is just personal, why don't we just do it for a while and just see what effect it has? And if it doesn't work, then okay, we've all been proved right, the non-mask wearing camp. But if it does work, then good, we've protected a pandemic. So, it seems to me a small price to pay, really, for our health. And new data from America apparently reveals that people under the age of 60 are 2.78 times more likely to spread the virus than the elderly. It also found that young people are more likely to be super spreaders of COVID than people over 60. Scientists have been discovering over the course of the pandemic that a small percentage of patients are responsible for a large amount of transmissions. The latest study mapped COVID-19 mobility data for five counties in the US state of Georgia between March and May. An analysis of almost 10,000 cases of COVID-19 reveals one-fifth of all infections come from just 2% of infected patients. And scientists say this highlights the importance of maintaining social distancing measures that may curtail close contacts with others. And experts from Emory University have written in a study that they've analysed cases between March and May in five counties, and overall about 2% of cases were directly responsible for 20% of all infections. And they estimate that the infected non-elderly cases, older than 60 years, may be 2.78 times more infectious than the elderly, and the former tend to be the main driver of super spreading. And I think we really need to think about, you know, even if we don't have symptoms, we could be spreading it to our elderly relatives. Every infectious disease is given a reproduction number, which is known as RO, pronounced R0, actually. It's a value that represents how many people one sick person will, on average, infect. And the R0 value for SARS, the virus that causes COVID-19, was estimated by the Imperial College response team to be 2.4 in the UK before lockdown started. Some experts analysing outbreaks across the world have estimated it could be closer to the 6.6 mark. And estimates of the R0 vary because the true size of the pandemic remains a mystery, and how fast the virus spreads depends on the environment. It will spread faster in a densely populated city where people travel on the trains than it will in a rural community where people drive everywhere. So
So it's thought to be at least three times more contagious than the coronavirus that causes MERS. Measles is one of the most contagious infectious diseases and has an R0 value of 12 to 18 if left uncontrolled, and widespread vaccination keeps it suppressed in most developed countries. And chickenpox's R0 is estimated to be between 10 and 12, while seasonal flu has a value of around 1.5. So the higher the R0 value, the harder it is for health officials to control the spread of the disease, and a number lower than one means the outbreak will run out of steam and be forced to an end. This is because the infectious disease will run out of new victims to strike. So we want to be keeping that R0 value right down, don't we? So I think the wearing of masks has got to be helpful, just for the time being. Anyway, that's my personal thought. And I would advise you all to stay as safe as possible. Right, we're going to have a little break now.
In my heart.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And we're talking the virus, still in the news, mask wearing, to wear or not to wear, and talking loudly or singing. That's also on the list of banned, or certainly singing is on the list of banned things in communal areas. But apparently talking loudly in pubs is just as risky as singing when it comes to spreading COVID, according to a new study. The research was used to inform ministers' decisions to allow indoor concerts and stage performances to resume last week. And it comes as a few weeks ago now, it comes as a major boost for the arts and entertainment industry, which has been obliterated financially by the pandemic. But questions will be raised about people's safety in rowdy pubs, where there is often music playing and revellers have to shout to be heard. Previous studies had indicated that prolonged singing produced more aerosols and therefore made it easier for COVID-19 to infect people. The virus is mainly released into the atmosphere when the infected produce plumes of droplets, often through coughing or sneezing. Smaller infectious particles, called aerosols, are released by talking loudly, and these can linger in the air for longer periods of time and can be inhaled. The latest paper, carried out by a team of British scientists and supported by Public Health England and the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, concluded that singing produced just as many aerosols as speaking loudly. Now, academics from Imperial College London, University of Bristol, Wexham Park Hospital, Lewisham and Greenwich NHS Trust and the Royal Brompton Hospital examined the amount of aerosols and droplets generated by 25 professional singers. The performers were asked to do singing, speaking and breathing exercises and were also examined while coughing. Exercises included individuals singing and speaking happy birthday at various noise levels. The researchers found that the aerosol mass produced rose steeply with an increase in volume of singing or speaking by as much as 20 to 30 times. But singing did not produce substantially more aerosols than speaking at a similar volume. There was no difference in aerosol production between different genres such as choral, musical theatre, opera, jazz, gospel, rock or pop. The study has shown the transmission of viruses in small aerosol particles generated when someone sings or speaks are equally possible, with both activities generating similar numbers of particles. Our research has provided a rigorous scientific basis for COVID-19 recommendations for arts venues to operate safely for both the performers and audience by ensuring that spaces are appropriately ventilated to reduce the risk of airborne transmission. It's a useful study, but it does have some holes in it. The researchers only analysed singers on a one-to-one basis, whereas live musical performances normally see multiple people singing at once. This is a useful and timely study showing that singing produces a similar particle size and number distribution as talking, but it is indeed the volume of singing, especially in large groups, that's important, with more particles produced as the singing gets louder, and this is the point. But the risk should not be overly underestimated or played down because of this. We don't want choir members getting infected and potentially dying from COVID-19 whilst doing what they love. Also, the study was performed on individual singers one at a time when the particle profile was found to be similar to talking. And again, this isn't necessarily the main problem. The risk is amplified when a group of singers are singing together, for example, singing to an audience, whether in churches or concert halls or theatres. So it's a good study, but not exactly representative of the real whole choir dynamic, which really needs further study to truly assess the risk of such large volume synchronised singing, vocalisations and exhalations. The government's scientific advisory group for emergencies earmarked live musical performances, and choirs are one of the more risky events for COVID. This is why music venues, indoor theatres and concerts were the very last amenities to reopen following lockdown. And in a report submitted sometime in June, Sage said it had reviewed a number of international studies and found evidence to suggest that singing can produce more aerosols or droplet nuclei than normal talking or breathing. COVID-19 is spread through respiratory secretions, which can take the form of large droplets or smaller aerosols. And these are either inhaled directly or transferred by the hands from surfaces where they've been deposited. And the document says the smaller the particle, the further it can advance into the respiratory tract. And they've said there exists some evidence to suggest that singing can produce more aerosols than normal talking or breathing. It may be more like a cough. Singing for any appreciable amount of time, therefore, may present a risk for the creation of infectious aerosols and allow for infection transmission. Therefore, at the present time, the safest way for groups to sing together is either to sing outside, to use the 2 meter rule, socially distancing, or avoid face-to-face positioning. So there we have the official line on singing and talking. It's amazing, isn't it, really? All these things that we never even thought about before COVID. And there's so much research around at the moment. It's difficult to know which one to choose and which one to believe, isn't it? But and research is certainly split over whether COVID spreads more easily in dry or humid air after two conflicting studies were released on the same day. Now, University of Sydney experts said that low humidity helps the virus to linger in the air for longer periods, leading to 8 new cases with every 1% drop in humidity. But University of Missouri academics claim droplets of the virus expelled by coughs and sneezes can stay in the air for 23 times longer in humid conditions. A finding supported research from China, where the pandemic began, but most scientific findings uncovered since the pandemic began have suggested the coronavirus has a preference for cool, dry conditions and is less successful in hot, humid ones. Coronavirus has killed around 750,000 people worldwide and has reached every corner of the planet, proving that no climate is immune to being ravaged by an outbreak. Swathes of studies comparing temperature and cases in different countries suggest those with low humidity and colder weather have fared worse. The flu is known to spread easier when the air is drier, researchers also say, and cold winter air holds less moisture. Now, experts have speculated that air without moisture dries out mucus in the nose and airways, making viral infection easier. People may also spend more time cooped up indoors with other people in colder weather when the air carries less moisture. Other studies have suggested hot temperatures drive cases down, bolstering the theory that high levels of humidity may have a protective role. Now, humidity levels can be expressed as either absolute humidity, specific humidity, or relative humidity. Gosh, this is getting very scientific now. Specific humidity is expressed as the ratio of water vapor mass to the total mass of moist air. It doesn't vary as the temperature or pressure of a body of air changes, as long as moisture is not added to or taken away from it. So relative humidity is the amount of moisture in the air compared to what the air can hold at that temperature. And if there is a 100% relative humidity, it means that the air is completely saturated with water and isn't able to hold any more. This also means that there's a strong possibility of rain. During a period of high temperatures, air with a very high RH is very uncomfortable as the saturated air affects our body's cooling mechanism, the Met Office explains. In low temperatures, air with a very high RH can make us feel cooler. Absolute humidity is the water content of the air regardless of the temperature and is measured in either grams per kilogram or grams per cubic meter. So SARS can survive in the air for longer in hot and humid conditions, academics at the University of Missouri have said. Transport and fate of human expiratory droplets plays a key role in transmission of respiratory infectious diseases, the team have said. Droplets are sensitive to environmental conditions, including temperature, humidity and ambient flows. And droplets exhaled in normal human breath come in a range of sizes from about 1/10 of a micrometer to 1,000 micrometers. The most common exhaled droplets are about 50 to 100 micrometers in diameter, a similar size as human hair. And this study looked at how airflow and fluid flow affects exhaled droplets using simulations and mathematical models. And in an environment with high humidity, a high concentration of water vapor present in the air, droplets can travel up to 16 feet away. High humidity can extend the airborne lifetime of medium-sized droplets by as much as 23 times, the study claimed. Dry air with a low humidity, on the other hand, can accelerate natural evaporation of the droplets and restricts the distance they can travel. So when there is zero humidity, regardless of the temperature, the droplets will evaporate in the air within seconds. And as the temperature increases, it spends less and less time in the air before dropping. When the temperature reaches more than 30 degrees centigrade, the virus will not spend longer than 5 seconds in the air. On the other hand, when the relative humidity is around 50%, the droplet will stay in the air for 7 seconds or more, even at very low temperatures. It starts to spend more and more time in the air as the temperature rises, up to 12 seconds when it's 30 degrees centigrade. So that kind of explains why
Germs are more likely to spread in the cold than in the warm.
Right, enough of virus talk for today. I think we're going to go on to some natural remedies. Well, I guess that's kind of virus connected as well, because it's talking about building up your immune system, which we could all do with a bit of, couldn't we? So, yeah, we'll have a little break now and we'll talk about some natural remedies right after this.
All the time that we spend together, I won't fuss, I won't fight, trying to make you mine. You know I'm not that kind. Woo! Come on. You know I'm not that kind. 'Cause I'm not that kind of girl.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. So, some natural remedies. Honey has always been a good remedy for an irritating cough, sore throats, and the common cold. But research now shows that honey is more effective at treating these ailments than antibiotics or over-the-counter medication. Experts at Oxford University said doctors should tell patients to have a spoonful of honey rather than prescribing antibiotics, which can fuel antimicrobial resistance. They reviewed studies which compared the effectiveness of honey against cough suppressants, antihistamines and painkillers when treating upper respiratory tract infections, which includes coughs and colds. Overall, honey was found to be superior at relieving coughs, sore throats and congestion, and unlike other medications, it had no harmful side effects. Honey was on average 36% more effective at reducing cough frequency than common medications, and it cut cough severity by 44% more. There was also evidence honey reduces the time it takes to recover from coughs and colds by up to 2 days. Honey was associated with a significantly greater reduction in combined symptom score, cough frequency and cold severity. That's according to the British Medical Journal. It added that the so-called nectar of the gods is cheap, readily available and has virtually no side effects. The authors also said using honey for infections could reduce the overprescription of antibiotics, which is fueling a crisis of antimicrobial resistance. Experts are increasingly worried that doctors too often dole out antibiotics for coughs and colds, for which they are rarely necessary because most of these are caused by viruses. The researchers said honey was superior to usual care for the improvement of symptoms of coughs and colds, and it provides a widely available and cheap alternative to antibiotics. Flu, etc., is the most frequent reason for antibiotic prescription, and since the majority of ailments are viral, antibiotic prescription is both ineffective and inappropriate. Given that a lack of alternative therapies and desire to preserve the patient-doctor relationship are two key contributors to antibiotic overprescription by GPs, finding that honey may be as effective is important. Honey is a reasonable alternative. Honey has long been used as a home remedy, and a few years ago the UK's medical watchdog included it in official guidelines for treating coughs, but there were limited reviews on its effectiveness, and the Oxford scientists reviewed 14 studies with about 1,700 participants to determine the impact of honey when treating upper respiratory tract symptoms. The 14 studies compared treating patients with honey against usual care, such as cough medicines and painkillers. They found that honey was more effective at improving symptoms, especially the frequency and severity of coughing. And in case of the antihistamine, diphenhydramine, honey was significantly better as it reduced cough severity by 50%. And two of the studies showed symptoms lasted 1 to 2 days less among those treated with honey. But the researchers cautioned that honey is a complex substance, so different types could have different effects. And the study concluded honey is commercially consumed and is safe for use by the majority of the population, apart from allergic individuals and infants under 1 year of age. Honey is a frequently used lay remedy that is well known to patients. It's also cheap, easy to access, and has limited harms. Now, when clinicians wish to prescribe for coughs and colds, it's recommended that they talk about honey as an alternative to antibiotics. It's more effective and less harmful than usual care alternatives and avoids causing harm through antimicrobial resistance. Honey should not be given to children aged under 1 year old due to the risk from bacteria that can produce toxins in a baby's intestines, leading to potentially fatal infant botulism. So no honey to little ones. Babies, tiny babies, but other than that, it isn't an old wives' tale at all. There is some truth in it. A spoonful of honey really does seem to relieve a cough. And this is firstly because it contains hydrogen peroxide, which gives it antimicrobial properties. And due to this, it has been used in traditional medicine as a topical antibiotic for centuries. And secondly, because it's thick and sticky, honey has a soothing effect on the throat that can reduce irritation and help relieve a dry, tickly cough. In addition to eating it straight out of the jar with a spoon, honey can be served with lemon in tea. So there we are, good old honey. I think that's great. The only other side effect of it, obviously, is that it's quite high in calories. So do go easy on it. And a spoonful a day probably is the ideal to be aiming for. So another problem that many of us suffer is gallstones, isn't it? So what can we do about gallstones? They are lumps of bile that form in the gallbladder of roughly 10 to 20% of adults in developed countries and around a quarter of women over 60. They can be as small as a grain of sand or as large as a golf ball, and they're thought to develop due to an imbalance in the chemical makeup of bile, the fat digesting juice made by the liver and stored in the gallbladder. In most cases, gallstones don't cause any symptoms and don't need treatment, but if a stone lodges in a duct and causes a blockage, abdominal pain, back pain, nausea and other symptoms can occur. About 10% of cases will become symptomatic within 5 years and 20% within 20 years. For patients with symptoms, surgery to remove the gallbladder is the standard treatment, but there's plenty you can do to reduce your risk of that happening.
So some of the things we can look at are to lose weight. Being overweight is definitely linked to gallstones, but avoid going on a crash diet. Losing a lot of weight rapidly can actually boost the chances of stones forming and causing you problems. So if you need to lose weight, aim to lose no more than around 3 pounds per week, and don't cut out good fats like the monounsaturated kind from plant-based foods and oils. Instead, cut down on your intake of refined sugars, eat small healthy meals at regular intervals, and exercise more. A good anti-gallstone plan, whether you're overweight or not. And nuts have been found to reduce the risk of gallbladder surgery, at least in women. They're not just rich in fibre, but also good fats and magnesium, all of which may play a role in preventing gallstone disease. Not the salted, sugared and highly processed varieties, though. Choose raw ones and aim for at least 5 ounces a week. And eating plenty of fibre, especially the insoluble kind, appears to reduce the risk of gallbladder surgery, possibly because it has a positive effect on bile acid metabolism. Good sources of insoluble fibre include whole grains, nuts, beans, lentils, legumes, berries, coconut, avocado, flaxseed and green vegetables. And get more magnesium. The higher your magnesium intake, the lower your risk of having symptomatic gallstones, according to one study. In addition to nuts, include plenty of magnesium-rich foods in your diet, such as leafy greens, quinoa, avocado, black beans, and pumpkin seeds. And for added insurance, take a magnesium supplement too. And a number of drugs may cause gallstones, so speak to your doctor about stopping the medication or suitable alternatives. If you're taking things such as estrogens, like HRT or the pill, progestins, such as medroxyprogesterone acetate, and the cholesterol-lowering drug clofibrate, and the antibiotic ceftriaxone, and incretin-based drugs used for type 2 diabetes. Women who regularly jog, run, cycle, or do other forms of physical activity are less likely to have gallbladder surgery, according to one large study. And other research suggests that around one third of cases of symptomatic gallstone disease in men could be prevented by boosting exercise levels to 30 minutes of endurance type training 5 times a week. The key is to find an activity you enjoy, so you'll be motivated to do it often. Even just taking regular walks can help. And try some herbs as well. Silmarin, the active component of milk thistle, may help prevent gallstones, as it's been found to reduce cholesterol levels in bile. And other herbs that may be beneficial include turmeric, Oregon grape, and the traditional Chinese herbs, Bupilurium and Lyscomacea, also called gold coin grass. Consult with a qualified herbalist who can advise on the right herbs and specific dosages for you as well. So there's lots of nice alternative remedies that that you can use to help various different infections and treatments. I mean, that's that list. I mean, I've done a few different natural remedies over the week, so there's so many, many more that you could use and include. I mean, dandelion greens and roots, yes, the weeds that grow in your garden. They're edible and they have medicinal and culinary uses. They're an excellent addition to salads and smoothies, and dandelion has long been used as a liver tonic. Dandelion roots contain inulin and levulin, starch-like substances that support microbiome health. And in fact, dandelions stimulate mucosal membranes all along the intestinal tract, which helps remove toxins from the bowel and also aids in their removal through the urine. Dandelions also contain taraxacin, a substance that stimulates bark production, and dandelion greens are commonly used in the production of bitters. And when the tongue recognises the bitter flavour, it sets off a series of reactions in the neuroendocrine system called the bitter reflex, which supports both digestion and detoxification. So there we are, the common old dandelion weed that I know I used to feed to my rabbits when I was younger. And should have put some on my salad plate as well. There we are. Right, well, that's it for this week. All our health tips and hints. I hope you found them useful. And stay safe out there. And don't be complacent, probably. The virus is still out there. So still do all that we can to keep it at bay. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.
Patagonia in South America. And I'm looking for something rather special. Yes, there he is. It's the sea elephant, and a big fella too. About 18 inches from tip to tail. That downturned snout's nearly 18 feet long.
Bum 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 b